What I'm going to talk about this evening is something very dear to my heart, very dear to the heart of my Dharma practice, my Buddhist practice, and that is imagination. And I'm going to talk a bit about why, for me, imagination has been absolutely crucial and central in my spiritual life for a very long time. So, to begin with, I'm going to invoke a friend of mine. Each day is a journey, and the journey itself is home. Each day is a journey, and the journey itself is home. Each day is a journey, and the journey itself is home. Each day is a journey, and the journey itself is home. So these are words of the 17th century Japanese poet Basho. And he's a wanderer. He's somebody who made long journeys, spiritual journeys. Physically, he travelled around the north of Japan. You may have heard about his travels. Viryapushpa went to Japan 2 or 3 years ago and visited some of the same places that Basho had visited. And he was a poet who was very influenced by Buddhism. He practically invented haiku poems as we know them today. And what fascinates me about him is that he took the metaphor of the journey of the spiritual life very literally. He made this great long tour around the north of Japan in about 1689. And he wrote a very, very famous travel journal that is known as the Narrow Road to the Deep North, or the Narrow Road to the Interior. And the meaning is very much twofold, that he was making this physical journey, but he was also making this journey within. And I think a lot of what I'm going to say this evening is about how we need to be able to hold these two things, to be aware of the metaphor of the journey, and that there's something physically that we do, but there's also a journeying inwards. So imagination can be like a realm. And it's a realm that we need to learn how to enter. And we all have different ways in. Another guide into that realm, another poet I wanted to mention is the poet David White, who some of you may have heard of. There's a poem of his which is called The Journey. And I experience it as an invitation into that more expansive realm of the imagination. The journey. Above the mountains, the geese turn into light again, painting their black silhouettes on an open sky. Sometimes everything has to be inscribed across the heavens so that you can find the one line already written inside you. Sometimes it takes a great sky to find that first bright and indescribable wedge of freedom in your own heart. Sometimes with the bones of the black sticks left when the fire has gone out, someone has written something new in the ashes of your life. You are not leaving, even as the light fades quickly now. You are arriving. So yeah, seeing the spiritual life as a journey is a metaphor. It's one that's perhaps the most common of a number of ways in which we can imagine what we're doing in living a spiritual life, practicing the Buddha's teachings. We talk about treading the path. We talk about following the Buddha, or just progressing through the journey of life. And the spiritual life is enacted in the imagination. Becoming aware, becoming conscious of the role of imagination in our lives is, I think, a crucial aspect of our spiritual practice. And it's particularly important for us in this particular Sangha, in this Triratna Sangha that we're a part of. As I'm sure we're all aware, this weekend just gone, we celebrated the first 50 years of our movement. We're really very young. We're a very young movement. We're still in the process of forming, in a way still in the process of dreaming ourselves into being. It's not that long compared with many other Buddhist lineages, some of which have been going for 1,000 years and more. And part of what we're doing, what is so unique about us, is that we're really seeking to find ways to let the Dharma really take root in Western culture. In Western culture, in whatever culture it finds itself in, it has to gradually put down the roots of the Dharma and grow new trees, new bushes, new flowers. Not just import wholesale the cultural forms of Buddhism that come from other countries. Wherever the Dharma moves and flourishes, it's like it grafts into the indigenous culture. And we're very much in the process of doing that, and our own imagination is such an important part of that. So we have a lot in common with the other lineages that already exist in the Buddhist tradition. We go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. We meditate, we practice ethics, we practice ritual. But we also, in Triratna, we have a number of distinctive emphases, which are things that we feel are very important, that Sangharakshita's taught as being very important as ways of us practicing, which are different. There are different emphases to other traditions. And imagination is one of these. Arts and imagination is one of our 6 distinctive emphases. There are others. I don't know whether you're familiar with this aspect of Sangharakshita's teachings. There's a new exhibition that's just appeared in the library at Adisthana celebrating these 6 distinctive emphases. So if you get up to Herefordshire, to the centre Adisthana any time this year, you'll see more about it. I won't go into them now, but I did just particularly want to mention it's one of our distinctive characteristics. If you go along to other Buddhist groups and talk about imagination, they'd probably go, "What? Why?" So I'm going to try and explain a bit more why that's so important for us. And as I'm sure many of you know, Sangharakshita, who founded our movement, he's a poet as well as a scholar. He's very much got these 2 sides. He's even said at some point in his life he felt like there was Sangharakshita 1, who's the poet, and Sangharakshita 2, who's the philosopher. And the great benefit for us, I think, is that we have all these different ways of approaching the Dharma. There's plenty of clarity, there's plenty of intellectual stimulation, but there's also poetry, music, imagination, art, many other ways of approaching the Dharma. So why does imagination matter? Well, I think it matters because of suffering. Really, all of us start out in the spiritual life for the same reason, otherwise we wouldn't bother. If we were quite content and satisfied with things as they were, we wouldn't practice the Dharma. And it was the same for the Buddha. He started practicing because of suffering. And he wanted to find the end to suffering. And one of the things I really love about the Buddha is that he was utterly uncompromising. Whatever he did, he really did it, absolutely. So as you know, he had this very luxurious upbringing. He is said to have been a prince or the son of a chief of a clan. And the stories say that he had a palace for the hot season and a palace for the cold season and a palace for the rainy season. He had all the luxury that there could possibly have been, a beautiful wife, a beautiful child. And that luxury wasn't enough to be the end of suffering for him. So he went forth and he decided to follow the holy life. And then he decided to practice the austerities. And there was a lot of traditions at the time that said by starving yourself, by mortifying the flesh, you could free yourself from the body. And he didn't just try that a bit. He tried it almost to the point of death. He just, for years, he really, really practiced. And he realised that actually this wasn't helping him to get free of suffering. And it was, these were two of the extremes between which he came to discern that there was a middle way. So we hear about the Buddha teaching the middle way. And it's the middle way between many extremes, the extremes of indulgence and asceticism, as I've said, but also between the extremes of nihilism and eternalism, or there being a complete distinction between self and other. The middle way that the Buddha taught finds a way between all these extremes. And for me, the imagination's been absolutely crucial in helping me really understand how to seek out that middle way between extremes. When I first started practicing, I was experiencing a lot of suffering, particularly from painful stuff from my childhood, other reasons as well, and I really wanted to know what the answer was. And I've got a good mind, and I thought that was all that was needed. I'd study the Dharma, I'd practice the Dharma, I'd understand the Dharma with my head, and it would all be fine. But I was a nihilist. I had great difficulty in believing in anything beyond the material, physical world. I had quite a bleak view of life, really. And I loved all the Buddhist teachings on shunyata, on emptiness, but I completely misunderstood them. I had no sense of loving kindness, metta, warmth in there. Basically, I didn't want to exist, and I had this very nihilistic view, and I was looking at the Buddha's teachings through this lens for a couple of years after I started practicing. And eventually I did realise, with the help of my friends, with a lot of help from my friends, that I was going too far in one direction. This wasn't going to lead to freedom. I had to concede that my head wasn't going to do it, and I had to involve more of myself, my heart and my energies, in some way, to keep going on the path, on the quest. And what I needed was to imagine a bigger vision. And I came to, as many of us do, I think, come to imagine the spiritual journey as if you're setting out in a sailing craft, very appropriate, being here by the sea. I grew up by the sea in Portsmouth, so I'm feeling very at home at the seaside. And you know, when you sail somewhere, you don't just go from A to B. You have to go with the prevailing conditions, with the winds, with the tides. You have to go, oh yeah, this time I'm going a bit towards eternalism, this time I'm going a bit more towards nihilism, and you correct. And you need this bigger vision, you need to imagine something that's going to allow the way that you can go with the prevailing conditions to move towards that vision that you've had, but not to be rigidly stuck on one course. And I think part of what we have to come to terms with, and this is shocking in our spiritual lives, is that there's more to us than we like to admit. There's a lot more to us than we like to admit. We're more than just a logical head pottering about on a pair of legs. We're powerful, and we've got energies that we don't dare unleash. There's that famous quote that many of you have probably heard. It used to be attributed to Nelson Mandela, but it was actually by Marianne Williamson, that says, our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we're powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. And we have to find a way to be able to encompass all that light, all that energy in us. And I think imagination's a key to these great energies that are inside of us. And one of the reasons that imagination's vital to the spiritual life is that if we don't use it, it will use us. Actually, it's so, imagination is so powerful, it's actually something we're using all the time, but we may not recognise it. We may not actually consciously harness it to the ends that we want. And if we don't guard our imagination and be conscious of how we're using it, it can be captured. And when we say, oh, my imagination was captured by this or by that, but if you really think about what this phrase is, our imagination being captured. Well, all sorts of things play on that. Consumerism plays on that. Our imagination gets captured by this beautiful outfit that's going to make everything all right, or this perfect house, or that wonderful car, or the ideal trip that's going to solve everything. Advertising and marketing executives are paid a lot of money to capture our imaginations. Yeah. And looking at a much darker aspect of it, we could say that a terrorist is someone whose imagination is held captive by an ideology, that they lack the awareness, the freedom of imagination to empathise with fellow human beings. You could say it's part of what happened with Hitler with the Second World War. He captured the imaginations of the German people with the Aryan myth. And we can see in different ways across the globe people's imaginations are being captured. And they're not actually that aware, that conscious of the way these energies are caught up in some great myth. So we really need to think, how can we consciously use our imagination and not let it use us? I think in our culture, we quite often tend to dismiss the imagination, almost like a bit of fluff. We'll say, oh, it's just imagination. It was only a dream. And I think there's a long cultural history here. You could say one of the things, and this is something Sangharakshita just talked about, you know, going back to the Reformation, you could say, and this is a big caricature, but tidy Protestantism replaced messy, colourful, magical Catholicism. And the imagination, the magic of it, has had a very bad press. It's like we've allowed ourselves to be conditioned to disbelieve in the power of imagination. And I was thinking, in some ways, it is almost like a superpower. You know, like you get that film, The Incredibles, about those superheroes like Superman or whatever. And it's like imagination is a kind of superpower, actually, if we can really find out what is the nature of our imagination, what really captivates us. And I'll say more about this later. Yeah. So yeah, you could say that these days our imagination gets held hostage to consumerism, anxiety, and all sorts of other things. We imagine all the time. It's a question of whether or not we wake up to that fact and start to bring more awareness to it. It's a power we can reclaim that can really, it changes the whole way that we see everything, and that transforms our lives, and then that can have an effect on other people's lives. But what is imagination? Well, we could say it's a way in which our minds can function. Sangharakshita suggested that we can think of imagination as a kind of faculty, like a capacity, like we've got sense faculties with which we see and we interpret and we operate in the world. Everybody's got this faculty in some form, but depending on whether we're aware of it and whether we use it and we develop it, we just might not be aware of it. And this imaginative faculty that we've got, it can operate in helpful ways and it can operate in unhelpful ways. There's a very famous talk that Sangharakshita gave very early on when he came back. In fact, I think it was 50 years ago, in 1967, he gave this brilliant talk where he talked about mind reactive and mind creative. If you've never come across this, I really recommend it. It'll be on Free Buddhist Audio. But he makes this really brilliant distinction between this way that we can just keep reacting in the same old way and keep going round and round. The same thing happens, we make the same response, and we just keep going round and round on the same wheel. Or if we start to bring awareness, something happens, and we don't immediately respond, we don't immediately react, we stop. We talk about staying in the gap, to bring in awareness, to start to actually make a conscious choice about how we're going to respond. And actually it's the same thing that the poet John Keats talked about in terms of creativity. He had this lovely phrase that he used once in a letter, I think, to his brother, where he talked about developing negative capability. And it was the capacity not to react, but to sit and to wait and to see what else arose, if a more creative response would arise. And in the teachings that we share on the way that conditionality works, we've got these two models. We've got the wheel that goes round and round. There's the reaction, and it goes round and round. But then we've also got the spiral. So you get to that point on the wheel where there's a gap between feeling and craving. You wait. And actually, if you've got the imagination to remember and to really have faith that there's something more than the same old round, then from that gap you can actually start to travel up the spiral to just a bit more awareness. A lot of the experience will be the same, but you've got a bit more perspective. You've got a bit more height, if you like. You can kind of see a bit more of the map, and you start to travel up the spiral path, which is what leads ultimately to that liberation that the Buddha experienced. So yeah, we have a choice. And it comes down to really practical things. So I'm talking about now about how you can think that there's a creative imagination and a reactive imagination. So I've talked about how you can imagine something painful happens and you can start to imagine a more positive outcome. But often we do just stay in that round with that mental proliferation that's so familiar. You know, there's even the technical Buddhist word, isn't there, for that reactive mind, prapancha, when we just, lots and lots of thoughts proliferate. So, for example, perhaps we've got a difficult phone call to make. We've got to tell somebody something, and we're quite sure they're not really going to like it, and we're quite anxious about it, and we start thinking, oh, and then they'll say that, and then I'll say that. But if they say that, I'll say that. And it might be like this, and then, and by the time you know where you are, you've got all kind of tense, and you're kind of, right, I'm ready to make this phone call. And the very fact that you've kind of braced yourself, and you're, that's going to communicate, and the communication that you make, that's the reactive imagination having done its thing. Whereas, if you can stay in the gap, you can connect with your heart, perhaps cultivate some loving kindness, some metta. Actually, you can soften, you can open, so you don't know what's going to happen. And yes, there might be something painful, but you just don't know. And you can be much more open, much more creative. You can also use your imagination to empathise with that person you're going to talk to. And it can create a whole different set of conditions for that difficult phone call. So something I wanted to mention was that if you go back and read all the early texts, you won't find a word for imagination. The Buddha didn't talk about imagination. And that's not because it doesn't matter. I think there was a lot about imagination that was so much part and parcel of the day-to-day life and culture in the time of the Buddha. They didn't need a special word for it. In the Buddha's time, there was this very alive sense of animism. There was this sense of everything was alive. Trees had tree spirits, rivers, woods. They weren't living in the kind of world we are today, where we've forgotten. We have this materialist view of things, that everything's just dead matter. And actually, we need to cultivate that sense of aliveness, of the possibility of change, of the possibility of transformation, of the possibility that if we see the living world as a living world, the universe that we inhabit is changed. It's completely changed. I mean, this was so much what the poet William Blake did. You know, he just saw everywhere his vibrant aliveness, to see the world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wild flower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. Everything he saw was suffused with imagination. And that's something we need to learn, but in the Buddha's time, I think they just had that. They just had that sense. So you don't find a word that you could say, oh, the Buddha said this about imagination here. But we've got a Pali scholar in our movement. He's a mate of mine. In fact, he lives downstairs from me, Divan. And he's looked into this because he's very interested in imagination. And he said there's words like sati that mean awareness, which when you actually look at how they're used in context, you can understand that there's a quality of imagination in awareness. So I think, I just mentioned that, because if you're anything like I was when I came along, I'd have gone away and gone, yeah, but it doesn't say imagination here, what's that all about? I think we have to take a sort of bigger view. Yeah. So. So if we can see imagination as a faculty, we can begin to recognise it is something we've all got. Lots of us have the view we haven't got any imagination. But actually it's like something, it's there in everyone, but it's dormant and it takes something to wake it up. And it's something we can strengthen just like a muscle by exercising it. And also, if we don't use it, it's something that can wither away, like a plant that doesn't get enough light and enough water. Imagination's very much connected with our inner life. Now, we may or may not be aware, we may or may not feel that we have an inner life. If we're accustomed, you know, as most people are, we're living out there, we're taking in, we're watching the television, we're on the internet, we're talking to people, whatever. If we never just sit still and sit quietly, we may never discover that we've got an inner life. And obviously, when we meditate, that's what we're starting to explore, starting to discover. In a way, meditation can wake us up to this universe within. If we hold ourselves open to the possibility that there is such a thing. But it can be a long time before we start to trust what you could call sort of inner prompting, something that just arises. It occurs to you, you don't know where it's come from. It's like, oh, what's that? There's a listening to an inner voice, perhaps. And sometimes they're like glimmerings, this sense that we have of something that's in us that wants to be attended to. I've often had the image of it being like when you light a tea light, and sometimes it's like the flame goes right down and there's just this little glimmer, and it's like, oh, there's something here, and you kind of might just have to very gently blow on it and just see there's something that you can encourage into life. And that sense of having this inner life, this life of imagination, it's what can really help us to have confidence that there's more than just what's out there in the material world. The Buddha taught that ultimately the root of all our suffering is that we're clinging to this ego, to this sense of we're an embattled self in this world of threat out there. And actually we create that with our mind, with our imagination. Yes, there's suffering, but we make it a whole lot worse by all the ways that we look at it and we think about it and we tell ourselves stories about it. There's a famous verse by a scholar who was a bit of a poet as well, actually, Chandrakirti. First conceiving an I, we cling to an ego. Then conceiving a mine, a mine, as in my own, we cling to the material world. Like water in a water wheel, helplessly we circle. And then he says, I bow down to the compassion that arises in all beings. I bow down to the compassion that arises for all beings. And it's that sense of an imaginative heart connection with another being that starts to bring us out of this sort of clench of ego clinging. And it is our imagination that can start to give us that sense, oh, there's a reality beyond ego clinging. There's something beyond the material world. There's something more than. How we conceive of that is different for all of us, but that fact that we have that sense of resonance, that it's not just this material stuff here, we're born, we die, that's it, nothing else happens. That's what karma and rebirth are teaching us about. It's a huge subject, can't go into that more now. We're going to have some time for discussion after tea. So, I just wanted to say a bit about how do we cultivate imagination then. Some of you might have heard of Vasantra, who you've just been on retreat with, I think. Mm-hmm. He's written some wonderful books called things like Meeting the Buddhas. And back in the early 80s, he wrote a lovely essay about the Bodhisattva ideal. This idea, the ideal of that compassionate response to the suffering of all beings. But he goes back to talking about how we need to start with capturing our own energies, our own imagination, waking up to a big vision. And he says, it is as if most people have only a very small proportion of their energies available to them, while the rest lie dormant. Part of the reason they lie dormant is that there's no cause to interest them. It's as if we live on the surface of life, while in caves deep underground, the kings and queens of our energies, the magicians, the dancers, the heroes and sages, remain quietly aloof, unable to raise any interest in our desire to become a junior manager, to live happily ever after with a librarian from Surbiton, or to captain the pub's darts team. Even our goals of becoming a bit more relaxed or finding a bit of peace of mind do not excite them. But if we aspire to reach the heights, then all of a sudden, in those caverns far below, ageless heroes will start up once more at the sound of distant trumpets and reach for their unfailing weapons. And goddesses will weave afresh the old spells which protect the daring. So I wanted to conclude what I've got to say by just talking about this lovely image that I came across when I was reading a book about the American poet Gary Schneider. It's called The Gary Schneider Reader, and it's got a really interesting introduction all about him and his life. And in it described him as a warrior of the imagination, a warrior of the imagination. And I loved that. And the more I thought about it, I thought, oh, I think that is, it's part of how, it won't speak to everybody. The image of the warrior doesn't. We all have different archetypes that speak to us. But me, for me, this image of the warrior of the imagination really spoke to me, because I think we're not on a level playing field here. It's not, there's so much that's stacked against us culturally in terms of really owning and having and practicing with our own imagination, our own creativity. There's so much that's coming at us. We're bombarded from all this stuff, from the media, you know, from the internet and so forth. Yeah, we really need to recognise that we need to be warriors of the imagination. Yeah. So this introduction was describing him as a warrior of the imagination at a time of the war against imagination. And there was this lovely description of the nature of the imagination that we're fighting for, in a way. The nature of imagination tends towards integration, inclusion, and intimacy. And as such, it is inimical to the alienation and homogeneity of corporate global capitalism, centralised government, and the other forces of darkness that regard the planet as dominion rather than domicile. Markets instead of hearths. So there's that real sense of, oh, what is this fight really for? What is it that we can most powerfully do? And one of the things that we can very powerfully do is learn to sit in that gap that we were talking about earlier. Learn to really recognise that point when we're tipping into the reactive imagination, the reactive mind, or when we're just taking a breath and sitting and allowing something more creative to emerge, giving some space and time to whatever there is in us that has a vision of a better world. And a really radical thing we can do is to sit with the Buddha. Just to sit with the Buddha. It is radical. It's stopping. It's not buying into anything. It's not buying anything. We're not consuming anything. But we're giving space and air to our inner life. And this practice goes right back all the way through the Buddhist tradition to the time of the Buddha when people could physically sit with the Buddha. And it doesn't matter how the Buddha appears to us. It doesn't have to be a visual image. There doesn't have to be any particular form. It's whatever sense of the qualities of the Buddha that we have, that sense of presence, that sense of curiosity. It might even be a sense of absence. It's like, oh, there's this longing. And there's that sense of, oh, there's this space where the Buddha would be, and I can't quite connect with it, but you know that there's something there, there's something more, something that helps to support us in that quest, in that finding, that inner spark with us, that sense of creativity, a sense of purpose. There's a lovely story from very early in the Pali Canon. I don't know whether any of you, I'm sure some of you have heard it, the story of Pingya. And he was a very old follower of the Buddha and very devoted to the Buddha. And one day he was rejoicing to his friend about the Buddha. And he said to his friend, "Up till now, before I heard Gotama's teachings, the Buddha's teaching, people had always told me this. This is how it has always been. And this is how it will always be. Only the constant refrain of tradition. A breeding ground for speculation. This prince, this beam of light, Gotama, is a universe of wisdom and a world of understanding. A teacher whose Dhamma is the way things are, instant, immediate, and visible all around, eroding desire without harmful side effects, with nothing else quite like it anywhere in the world." Hearing this, Bhavari, Pingya's friend, said to him, "Why don't you go and spend your every moment with the Buddha then?" And Pingya's reply tells us a lot about the power of his imagination. He says, "You see, sir, with constant and careful vigilance, it is possible for me to see him with my mind as clearly as with my eyes, in night as well as day. And since I spend my nights revering him, there is not to my mind a single moment spent away from him. I cannot now move away from the teaching of Gotama. The powers of confidence and joy, intellect and imagination hold me there. Whichever way this universe of wisdom goes, it draws me with it. Physically, I can't move like that. My body's decaying. I'm old and weak. But the driving power of purposeful thought, or imagination, propels me without break. There was a time when, writhing in the mud of the swamps, I could only drift from one stone to the next. But then I saw the Buddha, fully awake and free from defilement. It is like a bird that leaves the bushes of the scrubland and flies off to the fruit trees of the forest. I too have left the bleary half-light of opinions. Like a swan, I have reached the great lake."